Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 10th, 2013. It's lovely to be with you this Mother's Day weekend. I was remembering that last year my family gave me a programmable coffee maker, but then I fell in love with the French press method, and now that coffee maker is in the garage. Speaking of wasting money, that's our theme today. How to know when you're truly wasting it and what to do about it instead of just feeling guilty. And first up, it turns out you can waste a lot of money if you don't shop around for medical treatments. You probably heard this week that the federal government released new data about just how dramatically the cost of medical procedures varies from hospital to hospital. Tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. So what can you, as a smart consumer, do with all of these numbers? Dr. Jeffrey Rice joins us now. He's CEO of Healthcare Blue Book, and that's a free price comparison website. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Barbara.
This pricing data that the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid released, it's nothing new, right? It just hadn't been pointed out to laypersons before. So what should consumers take away from it?
Well, you're right. It's not new that hospital charges vary dramatically between different hospitals for different services. And the big takeaway for consumers are, despite the charge data that was released, there's a lot of room for consumers to shop around for hospitals and negotiate with hospitals to get a better value for their money.
Well, in case someone listening hasn't heard yet about these sticker prices for procedures, what are we talking about? And can you give us some examples?
Sure. You know, the pricing in healthcare for both outpatient services and inpatient services varies. You might pay $1,200 for a colonoscopy at one facility, and you might pay $4,000 or more at another facility. So there's a very, very large price variation. And by just calling ahead before you get your care and asking the facility and your providers how much it's going to be under your own insurance plan, or if you're a self-pay under a self-pay discount, you can find out exactly how much you're going to pay and get a much better value from the healthcare system.
How feasible is it to shop around, though, especially if you're a sick patient? You know, where do you even start that process? You need something and you need something pretty soon.
If you're in an emergent situation, then obviously, you know, as a patient, you don't have a great opportunity to be a consumer. But the vast majority of healthcare that the Americans use, it's not emergent. These are typically scheduled procedures. Some procedures and services are much easier to shop for than others. It's typically really easy to shop for outpatient procedures. Most independent facilities can give you a specific price, and they'll stand by that commitment. It's a little more difficult when you're dealing with larger inpatient facilities and inpatient services. Typically, they'll give an estimate, but they won't commit to that estimate, and so it can be much more difficult to shop for the inpatient services, even if it's not an emergency.
I'm thinking also many procedures rely on the quality of the doctor doing, say, surgery, and it can be very hard to get reliable information about doctors. So what recommendations do you have for choosing the best doctor for the best price and keeping in mind the cost of the procedures?
You know, let's start with the price because that's a very specific thing. You know, obviously at Healthcare Blue Book, you can look up the fair price for free. And then when you call and check with your providers on their price, you'll know whether, you know, it's a reasonable price or not. The healthcare quality data for physicians, you want to look at things like the board certification, their malpractice history, any special training that they have. On the facility side, you can look at the governmental website, the CMS website, which provides certain quality metrics for inpatient care. And you want to look at both the price and the quality. The good news for patients is that typically the lower price providers have as good or better quality than the higher cost providers. And there's study after study proving that, and it's a little bit counterintuitive for most patients. But it is absolutely true that you can find very high quality care at a very affordable price.
Can we as patients negotiate with hospitals or with our insurance companies? Is there room for that?
There absolutely is room to have that conversation with your providers. The number one most important thing is that you do that before you get your care. You wouldn't go buy a car without knowing the price or a house without knowing the price. If you're not in an emergent situation, it's absolutely the patient's right to know how much their care is going to cost them before they get treated. If you don't like the price, you can definitely call their providers. And providers do have the opportunity to negotiate with you as an individual patient. They do provide discounts all the time. The good news is the charge data that CMS released, that is the sticker price. And almost no patients pay the sticker price unless they don't have insurance and they're self-pay and they do get billed the sticker price.
It's really confusing, though. You're talking as if these prices are transparent and readily available. I've just had such varying success talking to doctors, to insurance companies, to hospitals about the real costs of things. Everyone refers you to someone else. It depends what your insurance pays. It depends on this. It depends on that.
I agree with you. It is very complicated. I don't want to make it sound like it is easy. It can take a lot of time to make all those phone calls. You know, if you go to get an oil change, you get one bill. If you go for a colonoscopy, you're going to get three or four different bills. And so you have to call three or four different providers and ask them the price, and that can take quite a bit of time. So I agree with you. It is not very easy, but when thousands of dollars are at stake and literally patients can overpay by $3,000, $5,000, or $10,000 or more on a lot of surgeries, for example, it's worth the time to make those phone calls and check with your providers.
Jeffrey Rice is a physician and CEO of Healthcare Blue Book based in Nashville, Tennessee. And thanks so much for this.
Thank you.
Here's a savings you might miss out on in the future: sales tax on online purchases. If you buy online, you might have noticed you often don't pay sales tax. Well, soon that might not be the case. This week, the Senate passed a bill designed to make it easier for online retailers to charge the tax. For a look at how we got here and what this possible change might mean for consumers, we turn now to Diane Yetter, president of Yetter Tax Consulting and founder of the Sales Tax Institute. And Diane, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I find this confusing. Sometimes I'm charged sales tax for purchases I make online. What rules already govern online taxes?
Well, that's a great question and has a lot of confusion in people's minds. So today, retailers or any seller that maintains a physical presence in a state is required to collect tax when it makes sales to customers in those states, regardless of the method of ordering. So whether you go into a store, you order through a catalog, or as most people do today, order online. So if the retailer has a retail store, somebody like Walmart that has stores all over the place, then they are required to collect sales tax whenever they ship to customers in states where they have stores. And then the other piece that sometimes people aren't as aware of because it's not as visible are things if they have a warehouse in the state, which is where Amazon and other more traditional online retailers without retail stores have to collect tax in the states where they currently maintain warehouses or maybe even employees that are working on their behalf.
And that's due to U.S. Supreme Court rulings back in the 90s, right? So why is
Correct.
Congress getting involved now if the Supreme Court decided this issue back then?
Well, actually, in the decision back in 1992, which was the Quill Corporation case, the Supreme Court actually asked Congress to deal with this. So we've been waiting for Congress to deal with it since 1992. And there have been bills that have been proposed virtually every year since then. So at this point, I think what's really triggering it is a couple of things. The first is the sheer explosion of online business, and then also just the economic condition of the states that they are really hurting for money. And so this is a way that the states can collect revenue that is actually due. So this is not a new tax at all. These are taxes that have been due. It's just that the consumers either are not aware of it or just take the position that let the state come find me. And the retailers right now are not obligated or have the requirement to collect the tax today.
Can you remind us what the idea was originally behind sales tax?
Well, the original idea back in the 30s when sales tax was first passed was simply the taxes that existed prior to that were predominantly income taxes and property taxes. And in the 30s, we had falling income because of the Depression, and we had falling property values because of what was happening with the economy. And states were actually, and the government was having to provide more and more services to the citizens, and they needed to find a way to raise that revenue. And what people were still doing was actually buying things because they needed to do that. And so that's where the sales tax was born. And Mississippi was actually the first state to pass a sales tax.
Now, if this legislation does go forward, and doesn't look all that likely in the House, but if it does and businesses have to retool these whole departments to deal with complicated state tax regulations, and they'll be charging us more taxes, doesn't that just automatically mean higher prices for consumers online?
That's hard to really say. It might. Obviously, there will be some additional costs that the retailers will incur. But at the same time, there's competition in the marketplace.
I'm curious how much charging sales tax tips the scales for consumers. You know, I crossed state lines back in the day to get a good deal on certain goods. I'm not saying it was liquor, but certain goods in states that didn't charge it.
Well, I think there are a couple of different positions out there. Certainly, a lot of consumers are saying that they don't want new taxes to be imposed on them, but this really isn't a new tax. It's the tax that has been out there. In terms of consumer behavior, a lot of the studies that I've seen say that consumers are likely to still continue buying online for the convenience of it. Certainly, what it might do is curb some of the activities where people are going into stores, checking out the merchandise, and then going home and buying it online. It might be that they will actually start just buying from the merchant directly.
Diane Yetter is the founder of the Sales Tax Institute. Diane, thanks for this.
You're welcome.
And now we have a quick follow-up to last week's show. We talked about travel, and one of our consultants recommended buying travel insurance for certain kinds of trips. He said it could save you a bundle. Our listener, Pamela Poon, begs to differ. Here's Pamela.
My husband was leaving for a business trip to Bolivia, and his 96-year-old father had had some health problems, but he was pretty stable. And we just thought, gosh, if things take a turn for the worse, it might be a good idea to take out trip insurance. I called, made sure that they covered the illness of a family member who is not traveling before we purchased it. We purchased it, and it turned out there was an emergency. My father-in-law's health rapidly went downhill. My husband had to make an immediate return trip back to see his dad. Luckily, he got to see him for 3 days, but the whole application claim process took 4 months, at least 10 phone calls. We had to supply a ream of paperwork, a death certificate, a doctor's written explanation that my father-in-law's health was stable, and they still denied it. And they said it was because it is considered a pre-existing condition if the person who died saw a doctor within 6 months of the time that the trip occurred. The policy cost $78.75. That was a waste of money.
You waste money. This week we heard from a lot of you about your morning lattes, lottery tickets, and lunch dates. One listener said she buys far too much chocolate, but that's not a waste of money. That's just a necessity, right? And that's the thing. Waste is subjective. Here's a fact, though, about personal finance. You have to plug the leaky holes in your spending to stick to a budget. So we've invited a pair of listeners on the air for a little tune-up of their out-of-control spending. Carrie lives in Charleston, South Carolina, where she works as an orchestral musician. Hi, Carrie.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. And Seth is a management consultant based in Houston, Texas. And welcome to Marketplace Money, Seth.
Hello, Barbara.
Now, one more introduction, Carrie and Seth, before we grill you about your spending habits. I'd like you to meet Paula Pant. She's a personal finance journalist and author of the blog Afford Anything. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you. Wonderful to be on the show.
Great. Now, before I let you loose on our profligate spenders, can you lay down some guidelines for us? Because we all waste money one way or another, and I'm pretty sure that I don't want to hang out with people who never waste a dime. So given that, how should people think about where to draw the line on their budget leaks?
First of all, there's a difference between wasting money and using money in ways that you enjoy. So don't fall into the trap of thinking that any money that you spend on fun or entertainment is necessarily a waste. I mean, those are the memories that you're creating that you'll look back on 20 years from now and think, wow, I really enjoyed those times in my life. That's not a waste at all. In fact, it's arguably some of the highest and best use of your money, as long as you do it in a constrained, judicious fashion.
Well, that's the trick, right? Now, Seth and Carrie, let's see how you're doing with that. Carrie, why don't we start with you? Where does your money disappear to every month?
Going out. Going out after concerts, meeting up with friends, going to happy hour. I live alone and I spend a lot of time practicing, so I'm usually at home kind of all day by myself unless we have rehearsal. And so if somebody wants to go out and they send me a text, then yeah, I'm there.
Right. You're an orchestral musician. We said it's not exactly a partying crowd, right, who you work with?
It depends on the age or the constitution of the player. there's a lot of fun times that go on in the orchestral world.
But you do need to have a good time and to have some social time. So, okay, I think I've got a fix on you. Now, Seth, how about you? How much are you wasting and what do you waste it on?
All right, Barbara. So my business requires me to travel every week. So I'm posted up in hotels during the weekdays. And when I get off work, I waste my time on ordering hotel movies that are still in theaters. And my friends are big movie buffs, so I got to keep up with the shows that are still in theaters. As we all know, these hotel movies are around like $19.99 plus tax. And I only really order a movie a week, but over like a month, that's around like $90. And if you spread that out over 9 months, it's quite a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm thinking, though, it's better than emptying the minibar.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's true.
Paula, it seems that these two callers have something in common. I mean, they're spending money on their social lives. Sounds like healthy behavior to me. What do you think, Paula?
As a general rule, I mean, there's nothing wrong with spending money on entertainment. And in fact, there's a rule of thumb that says that you should spend roughly about 50% of your money on necessities, another 30% on discretionary spending, and then 20% on savings. And that's just a general rule of thumb. It doesn't apply to each and every specific case. But if that entertainment is contained within that 30% portion, then generally speaking, assuming you don't have any huge credit card debt or anything like that that should be addressed first, and assuming that you're saving enough for retirement and taking care of all of those things, then there's nothing wrong with spending money on your social life and on entertainment.
Well, Carrie, maybe I don't know if you have pencil and paper there, but how does that equation work for you? Is hanging out at happy hour hurting you financially?
Sometimes I go a little overboard with the going out. Looking at those percentages, just knowing what my budget is, my symphony budget is basically entirely necessities and savings. And then I have a couple of private students, and that's basically the money that I use to go out with. But sometimes that can mean spending, you know, anywhere from $80 to $100 over the course of one night going to different bars. So I realize that that is a little bit excessive.
I don't mean to pry too much, but can you give us a sense of how much you do make as a musician?
Yes. Our symphony salary is $20,000 a year, and I probably make another couple thousand with teaching.
So you're living tight. Paula, you want to weigh in here?
Absolutely. First of all, I can definitely relate to your experience of needing social interaction. I also work by myself, and when you're, especially if you're an extrovert, you know, I understand the feeling that you get to the end of the day and you want to talk to somebody. You've been at home in your pajamas talking to your cat the whole day.
Yes, exactly.
So the thing that I would advise you to do is to separate out wanting to socialize with your friends from needing to spend money when you do it. And there are actually two different ways that you could tackle this. What I think a lot of personal finance experts would tell you, a lot of people would advise that you change where you go when you hang out with your friends. So instead of going to bars or to clubs, you could go take a walk through the park, you could go on hikes, you could just invite them over and you can hang out in your living room. That's certainly one tactic, and that's something that a lot of people would advise. I actually wouldn't recommend that, and here's why. It's hard enough to change your own behavior. It's almost impossible to change the behavior of your friends. You know, you can't force anybody else to change, and if your friends are going to go to the bar, that's where they're going to go, and you can't force them to do otherwise. My advice would be, instead of focusing on changing where your friends hang out, I would change what you do when you get to the bar. So instead of buying four or five drinks, buy a beer, buy a PBR, some kind of cheap beer, no disrespect to PBR, and nurse it for an hour or two. You know, you'll still be there. You'll still get the social interaction, but you'll only be spending a couple of bucks on a single drink rather than $80 or $90.
Yeah, rather than my usual Manhattans.
The one other thing that I would like to say is, Carrie, I think that you should really focus on earning more money. I mean, $20,000 plus a couple thousand extra is, it's not that much.
No, I know that. And The thing is, the way the orchestral world works, you can only audition for orchestras when they post an audition, as in there's an opening. San Francisco just posted, and that audition will be next winter, and that would be a jump to about, that salary is probably $200,000. But of course, there's going to be 100 people that audition for that after they screen the 300 resumes that they get. So there are really probably only about 20 working orchestras in this country right now.
I know you make some money giving music lessons on the side.
Yes.
Do you have the time and the ability to ramp that up to do more private music lessons or to do the same number but teach it to higher paying clients?
Or perhaps perform in other venues?
I definitely do gig around. I mean, we all gig around because, everybody realizes that we don't make a lot of money. Like, I don't play the violin or the flute where you could have 30 students. I play the oboe. So there's only so many kids that play the oboe. I do make reeds as well because we make our own reeds for the oboe and I sell those.
Oh, that's great, because that's something that you could really scale.
But I can't spend all my time making reads that I'm going to mail out because I need practice time and need to make my own reads. But yes, expanding my income. I know, definitely living the starving artist lifestyle now.
Keep focusing on those side gigs that can earn you some extra money.
Yeah.
Seth, we don't want to leave you hanging. How's your financial situation? Are you doing pretty well?
So I am. This is my first job out of college, and since I'm traveling on the weekdays, I decided to sublet my apartment in Houston and post up with my parents. I was fortunate enough for them to take me in and put up with me. So I'm actually putting away about 70% of my paycheck into various savings accounts, Roth IRA. A traditional 401k, like an emergency fund. Basically, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and marketplace money, yeah.
Of course you are. So you just have this $90 ticket item of movies.
Yeah, probably about 90 bucks a month, 90 to 100 bucks a month.
So, I mean, Seth, you're doing really, really well. Saving 70% of your income is fantastic.
Unbelievable.
And especially, you know, when you're young and that money can really compound dramatically throughout your lifetime, you're in a fantastic position. And so if you were to tell me that you were spending $90 a month on something that you loved, I wouldn't blink an eye at it. I'd say, that's fantastic. Go for it. Heck, double it.
Do you love the movie, Seth?
Yeah, I do. Every once in a while, though, I fall asleep because it's kind of late. So I feel like I wasted about 10 bucks of the movie. I just feel like I could spend my money elsewhere.
I mean, so that is actually the part that I would latch on to, that you're not sure where you could spend it, because it seems to me like what you're really lacking is, this is something that I write about often, it's what I call the big why. And that's the why you're saving. What is your money for? Because without knowing that why, without having that huge goal that keeps you committed, you'll always be at the risk of frittering away money, of buying a $20 movie and then falling asleep on it. And if it's not going to be a movie, it'll be something else.
Sure, you could always watch movies on your laptop.
Yes, it's not the same, but it would save me a lot of money.
Now, Paula, just in the spirit of fairness to Seth and Carrie, I should ask you, what do you waste your money on?
Good question. Honestly, I spend too much money on home improvement. I bought a bit of a fixer-upper about 3 years ago. I got a great deal on it, and I think because I got such a good deal on this house, but it was in such bad need of repair, I've been over-fixing it and over-repairing it and making it a little bit nicer than it needs to be.
I love it to hear when a personal finance expert buys a money pit. Good luck with that. I think we're all done with our lecture for today. Thanks so much to Carrie and Seth for sharing their stories about wasted money. It was great talking to you both. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And special thanks to personal finance journalist Paula Pant. Her blog is called Afford Anything. And Paula, thanks so much for giving us some advice on that score.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
As we were planning our show about wasting money, we didn't just consider the little things that add up. We throw money away on big ticket items, too. take education. This week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau published a report that identified student loan debt as a roadblock to what it calls a full financial life for consumers. It seems the burden of paying for college is preventing a whole generation of educated young people from owning homes and saving for retirement and becoming entrepreneurs. With all that in mind, we asked you to tell us whether you've ever thought your costly college education wasn't worth it. And plenty of you were quick to tell us that you considered your degrees a waste of money. In a moment, we'll hear about people who've chosen alternative paths to education. But first, our Facebook friend Kat Greger has thought a lot about the value of her degree. She went to art school in New York City and graduated in 2008. And she joins us on the phone now from her home in Pittsburgh, PA. Welcome, Kat.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand you have some hefty student debt from that art degree. How much are you in for?
I'm over $206,000.
Oh, that must make you stagger when you say that, right? What's your job situation?
I work at a nonprofit. We have an art school program, and I'm student services here. I work here, and I really love it. I interact with high schoolers daily. So while I'm able to put my federal loans on forbearance, because I make so much less income than somebody working at a corporate job, I still haven't really been able to do much about my private student loans, which are the bulk of my student loans.
Well, how do you feel about your art degree? Looking back now, was it worth it?
When I really think about it, it was worth it. It was one of the greatest periods of my life, really. However, I'm not sure monetarily if it was completely worth it. I've had plenty of time to think about it in the 5 years since I graduated, what I could have done differently to ease the burden.
Well, if you had to do it over again, would you perhaps have chosen a different path?
If I knew now what I knew then, I would definitely do it a little bit differently, probably get some core stuff done in community college. If I even went to college at all, I might just immerse myself in different studios that do what I wanted to do.
Kat Greger is a Marketplace Money listener, and thank you so much for telling your story.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what do you all think? How much is too much to spend on an education? And what choices are out there for people who think a traditional, expensive education is a waste of money? Keo Stark has some ideas about this. She interviewed scores of people wrestling with these questions for her new book, Don't Go Back to School. And they came up with lots of alternatives. Keo, it is so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk with you.
Well, what are your thoughts on Kat's story? Does it sound familiar?
It sounds extremely familiar. And I did hear a lot of people talk about what they valued in school when they went. A lot of that had to do with the socialization and having a sort of safe space to grow up.
Well, how do you know if you're the kind of person who will do well outside of mainstream education?
It's a choice that people don't know that they have. A lot of people think that they need to have the structure of school in order to learn. And one of the things that was important to me in writing the book was to give people a sense of how you can accomplish that without the structure of school, to give models and techniques. It's not easy. It's not easier than school, but it's cheaper.
Well, you talked to a lot of artists mm-hmm. who, unlike our listener Kat, did not finish their art degrees. Why did they leave and what did they do instead?
One of the people I talked to is a man named Chris Bathgate, who's a successful artist. He makes sculpture that is generally mechanical. And he did go to art school for a year. He had three jobs in order to pay for it. The most important thing for him is that he wasn't learning any of the things he needed to learn to make his work. He was learning a lot of art theory and decided that it would be better for him to invest the money in the machinery he needed and taking the time to learn how to use it.
College education still does beat out any number of other ways to invest your money. Median earnings for a grad with bachelor degrees were more than 50% higher than for people with only a high school diploma. So how did the people that you talked to deal with this return on investment aspect of their decision?
For a lot of the people I talked to, either they didn't have the money in the first place and they didn't have a position in life that they thought they would be able to pay off debt. And so they were very wary of getting into debt. I think people always worry about, will I be able to get a job if I learn outside of school, if I don't have a degree? And all the stories that I collected showed that people have every opportunity to find work without having a degree. So I think 5 years from now, given the economic situation we're in, employers are going to have to respect people who have learned outside of school and their credentials are their experience.
Keo Stark, her new book is Don't Go Back to School. And thanks so much. It was really good talking with you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Are you swimming in student loan debt like our listener Kat? Or perhaps credit cards are costing you instead? For next week's show, we'd like to hear about how debt has affected your relationships with the people in your life. Whether you have personal loans to pay back to a friend or a family member, or you're deep in with a bank and it's affecting your marriage, write to us with your debt stories at marketplacemoney.org. Just a bit earlier in the show, we heard from some of you who struggle with overspending on things like first-run movie rentals and nights out on the town. Of course, getting unnecessary spending under control is an essential part of planning for the future and reaching your financial goals. Goals like buying a house, having a baby, or taking a big vacation. These are hard things to achieve even when you aren't blowing money on little everyday treats. Gail Cunningham joins us now to help us better budget for the future. She's with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. And welcome, Gail.
Happy to be here.
Now, if you listen to the show at all, then you know it's important to budget. But what exactly does that mean? Does it really mean you literally have to create a document and track everything you spend?
Well, you know, a lot of people consider budget a four-letter word. And I tell those folks that if they can't tolerate thinking that they have a budget, and if that sounds restrictive to them, call it a spending plan. But actually, a budget is meant to free up your money. You know, we work very hard for our money, and typically we spend it very casually. So let's adjust those to be in a better alignment by knowing where our money goes.
Well, what is it, though? Why does it have such a bad rap? And what are people struggling with the most? Is it just that sheer sitting down and doing it, or the self-discipline aspect, or I don't know, the emotional aspect of facing what you have and don't have and spend?
I think all of the above. Seeing your spending staring back at you in black and white is very eye-opening. And a lot of people feel that that might be burdensome, and maybe it is, but I say you can do anything for 30 days. Write down every cent you spend. Look at your spending and decide as a unit. You know, we're ordering pizza in 3 times a week. I think I could live with 1 time a week and move that money around. It's the only way you're going to truly be in charge of your money.
Okay, now that we've set down some guidelines, let's take a call. Andrew is on the phone from Silicon Valley, California. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So what do you do there?
So I'm in product management in a large but fast-growing technology company, and my wife works in the solar industry.
Well, great. You wrote on our Facebook page asking for help with budgeting for a house, but you also mentioned that you and your wife already have cut back on spending and you have a budget. So why don't you first tell us what kinds of things you're doing?
Sure. So we just moved. We were out in Silicon Valley and we're in Philadelphia for about 7 years and just moved back here about 3 months ago. We have, thanks to my wife, big budget categories. So we have money allocated to our 529K. We have a 2-year-old daughter. So for her college savings, we're putting away as much, maximizing our 401Ks. But then we have rent that we obviously have to pay, daycare expense. You know, we don't have cable. We don't take huge vacations. But at some point, we'd like to buy a house out here. And I guess, you know, my questions then are around, how do we do that? Do we stop spending on the things that we consider important? You know, do we take our 2-year-old and put her in the fields and start working? You know, short of that, it's not clear to me what we should be looking at. We're really considering all the options. Right. We've considered everything.
And coming from Philadelphia, you must have terrible sticker shock.
Right. We knew about it because we started here before, and we did own a house. We were fortunate enough to own a house in Philadelphia, but you know, housing prices there were in the threes, could get you a pretty decent house. And here, you know, there's really not anything below 900 for, and this is not extravagant. I wouldn't buy that same product on the East Coast, but you know, for $900,000, you get a reasonable 3-bedroom house.
Welcome to California, Gail. Any suggestions?
Well, Andrew's doing a lot right. So first of all, I want to say hats off to you. You're prioritizing and you're literally putting your money where your mouth is. So good job. Now, I too find that daunting. I hear $900,000 to buy a modest house.
Right.
I'm going to fall off my stool here. But, you know, buying a home, we used to always tell people that that is obviously part of the American dream and is necessary for wealth building. And as we all have learned, some of us the hard way, homes do not always appreciate in value. So know that renting is not all bad. As a matter of fact, a lot of folks use a rule of thumb that if it's going to cost you 35% more to buy a home, live in that home month after month, year after year, then you might be a better candidate for renting. Also know that the hard, cold truth is that it's going to take a lot of money to get into that house. You're in a perfect world going to have to come up with 20% of a down payment. Now, admittedly, I need to tell you there are some entities that only require around 3% up front, so you could pursue those, and that would make it much more palatable. But it's a lot of upfront cash, even if you decide you can swing the monthly payment. I think a good place to start is with one of the calculators. Many of those are available online about how much house can I afford. That'll give you something to shoot for.
Andrew, I hear Gail steering you gently or firmly towards renting. How does that sit with you?
It probably sits better with me than it would my wife, and just the only thing that, you know, is a consideration for us is how long we're going to stay here, right? And then, you know, the renting versus owning comes into play.
Andrew, I really wish you good luck.
Great. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thanks so much for calling in.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's take another call. We have Beth on the line from Oakland, Florida. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Where is Oakland, Florida? And I'm fine, by the way. Thank you.
We're 10 miles west of Orlando.
Okay. What do you do there?
I'm a second grade teacher.
Oh, lovely. Now, Beth, yes. What can Gail do for you today?
Well, I had a question about my savings. I'm very fortunate to have the summers off, and I would like to travel. I have about $7,000 in my savings account, and I want to go to New York for about a month. The only problem is it's probably going to take most of my savings, so I'm not sure if I should do it or not.
Ha. Huh. Do you have any other options you're considering?
Well, I also was thinking I would like to do something to supplement my income. So I thought about maybe purchasing a rental property with that money as a down payment.
Okay. So you're choosing between investing, a money-making proposition, and a trip to New York.
Yes.
And you sounded really excited when you said that. Is this a dream of yours?
It really is. I've been thinking about doing this for years. I love it there. And I figure if I can go there for about a month, it would just be fabulous.
I'm a big fan of New York. I used to live there, so I'm a little biased here. But let me ask you before I let Gail loose on you, what's holding you back?
I think it would take most of my savings. Just a room, I think, would be about $3,000. And it does seem a little self-indulgent. I feel like maybe I should use it as an investment, but maybe this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing and I should just do it.
Gail, what do you think?
Well, Beth, I think you have lots of positive financial habits, and so I applaud you for those.
Thank you.
I will tell you, though, I would recommend that people save towards certain goals. And I'm the type of person that I have to put it in different categories. So I'm going to suggest that moving forward, or even taking that money, the existing savings that you have, split that up between your dream money, your dream vacation money, and your investment money, and your money that you just need to have in case the bottom falls out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to add another category, that long-term money that those of us like Barbara and myself, we cringe when we have to say it. You know, used to, you would hear people like us admonishing consumers to have between 3 and 6 months income socked away in the bank in case the bottom falls out. And now, since it's taking so much longer to replace your job, even in the education field, we're now saying 9 months of income.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's a daunting amount of money. And that's why we're scared to say it. I guess I'm feeling brave today. But really, you know, you worked hard for that money. Make it do what you want it to do. My knee-jerk reaction to your New York plan is no, because I'm afraid that you may come home feeling worse than when you went, because even though you had a good time and you have the memories to cherish, you'd be starting at ground zero again, building up your savings.
Right.
Now,
but Gail, it's a dream. Let her dream.
I know. But you know, I like for people to make financial decisions with their head, not their heart. And so when you, that dream can come alive next summer or the summer after that. It doesn't have to happen this summer. And I want to keep you grounded. When we did our annual financial literacy survey, the NFCC found out that people's number one worry was a lack of savings.
Okay.
So that's a very uncomfortable position to be in.
And Beth, I feel like we just squashed your your great joy.
No, I wanted an honest answer. It's probably what I needed to hear. Not what I thought I was going to hear, but what I needed to hear.
Really? You thought we were going to say go to New York?
It's to have use your money for the experiences, I thought maybe. I was hoping.
That's still true, but let's make that true next summer. And like I said, you have such positive financial habits. Just maximize those and keep doing what you're doing, and I think all your dreams are going to come true.
Thanks.
Not to undercut you, Gail, but I'd maybe lobby for 2 weeks in New York or even 1 week in New York. I'm still hanging on to the dream.
Yeah, I could do that. Make it a little bit shorter. That would still be a nice trip.
That's a nice compromise.
Yes.
Good luck,
yes.
Beth.
Thank you both so much.
I hope you have a wonderful summer, no matter what you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gail Cunningham is with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Thank you so much for this straight talk today.
Loved it. Thank you for having me.
Look, we know it's a Hallmark fabricated holiday and all that, but the numbers don't lie. Plenty of you are celebrating Mother's Day this weekend, and I hope you're having fun with it at least. As to those numbers, the National Retail Federation says consumers will spend $20.7 billion on gifts this year, an average of $169 per mom. I feel like a line item in defense spending or something. We have other eye-popping statistics and charts on how Mother's Day spending compares to other holidays at marketplacemoney.org, if you're curious. And we asked you on Facebook what sort of Mother's Day gifts all that money buys. You said everything from a vacuum to a chainsaw and an iPad. One of you has something quite spectacular in mind, although a chainsaw is pretty spectacular. Terry Mead joins us from Redwood City now. She owns an IT consulting company and is a licensed helicopter pilot. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I've kind of given it away, but here goes. What are you giving your mom for Mother's Day?
Well, I am finally taking her up flying in a helicopter. After having my license for 5 years, she's finally agreed to go up with me.
Oh, wow. And how much will that gift cost?
Well, I'll probably take her up for about an hour. So in the R22 that I'll take her up, that's about $275.
Okay. Well, I know it's wonderful that you're doing this now, but I know that you're a mother yourself, and you've got a 12-year-old son, right, and an 8-year-old daughter?
I do.
Do you know what they're planning to get you, given that you'll be kind of busy on Mother's Day?
Well, I know that they'll make me cards, because that makes me happy. We're not big on exchanging gifts on these holidays that you go and purchase. It's really all about spending time, because I'm going to cook dinner for my mother-in-law and my mother on Sunday night as well.
Terry Mead, she's a Marketplace Money listener and a pilot who's giving her mom a helicopter ride for Mother's Day. I hope you and your mom have so much fun.
It's going to be fabulous flying over Alcatraz and the Golden Gate Bridge. It will be so much fun just to spend time with her.
Oh, that's a great image. Fly safe.
Oh, thank you.
Now, we can't let that go without some trenchant Mother's Day budget analysis. And I'm joined now in the studios by the one and only Paula Poundstone, comedian and mom of three. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me. This thing of taking your mom for a ride, such a beautiful story. And none of my kids drive, but if they did, I think they would gladly drag me behind the car.
Oh, well, you heard Terry. Top that. Paula, what did you or what do you give your mother, your own mother, for Mother's Day?
I don't give my mother anything. And I don't ask. In fact, I specifically, when my kids were little, you know, maybe when I told them don't do the Mother's Day thing, they thought it meant just take it all for granted, which wasn't my plan. But I also think that there's like this get out of jail free card on the Mother's Day idea that, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. So long as you, you know, get a card or some flowers, that the rest of the year you can just, you know, be shabby in your relationship. And I don't feel good about that. You know, I think one Mother's Day we might have gone to Go-Kart World, but it was only because we figured the lines would be down. Because how many mothers go, you know, please,
that's right,
Go-Kart World.
But to play devil's advocate.
Yes.
Gifts are fun, and especially gifts that don't cost anything.
I'm trying to think what I would want, and this is really reaching, but I would like it if on that special, special day, at least one of my children came up to me and said, "How are you?"
Oh,
I know.
You set the bar
high. It's a lot. It's a lot to ask. Yeah, maybe it's crazy. That's crazy. You know what? I'll take the helicopter ride. I love, you know, she didn't tell the whole story about the helicopter ride. There may may have been something more macabre there about the helicopter ride. You know what I mean? Like, "Mom, look out the window. No, further, further." You know, I ask people to do stuff for me. I just don't ask for gifts.
So you believe in a barter economy. You're just not, you're not really into the...
Like, isn't there a town in Greece that's doing that now?
Express yourself through money. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, I might have heard about it on Marketplace.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, a town in Greece that's making the... And I thought about it. I thought, wait a minute, if I were to go there, what on earth could I trade with? I'd go, like, I have a little joke. And I'd get, like, one olive. That's the best I could ever do in Greece. That's
why. A really good one. You can go for five.
Yeah.
Getting back to money and personal finances... What advice have you given your kids about money and gift giving?
Listen, there is no topic on which I have not given my kids terrific advice. It's simply a matter of whether or not they listen to it and pick it up. But I'm, in fact, thinking of putting a lot of my advice out on DVD for them.
And charging them for it.
Honestly, because I say it so often, and it's such brilliant advice. I don't understand how they can't see that.
Okay, give us a taste.
About money?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've encouraged them to work for their money, to save their money, and to save the rewards for after the basics are paid for.
That is so sage and cogent.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I'm not even always done it, by the way. I'm saying listen to my words, not my behavior. But I've also encouraged them to wait to start a family until they've enjoyed those years where you can sleep on anyone's couch and it doesn't matter because you don't have to get up and rush home to take care of someone.
Right.
I thought that was really good advice.
That's just a no-brainer. Yeah.
You would think.
Uh-huh. Well, one last money question.
Yes.
What have...
Do I have any? No. I work for public radio. Of course I have none.
You know, our whole show today is about budgeting and spending. And I have to ask you then, what advice have you given your kids about that?
Yeah, the budgeting thing is a plan ahead of time where you say to yourself, here's how much I'm going to make, and therefore here's how much I can spend.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. This whole thing has been therapy for me. It's just been so good to come and talk to somebody with headphones
on. I'm so glad. Anytime, Paula.
I really appreciate it. I really do.
Paula Poundstone, she's a regular on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a mom of three children who won't be buying her anything for Mother's Day. At least not with her money. Happy second weekend in May, Paula.
Well, thank you so much to you, too.
Thank you. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the military offers lots of resources to help troops get out of debt, but many members don't take advantage of them. We'll hear why. And that's coming up next week when we focus on debt. And we want to hear your debt stories as well, specifically how you got out of debt, what helped you, and the lessons you learned. You can write them to us on our website at marketplacemoney.org, or you can post your stories on our Facebook page and keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Robbie Carmen is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Ure. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.